Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And today on the show, I'm so excited about this one. I talk to comedian Frank King. Now, if you're not familiar with Frank King, you absolutely should be. He's a hilarious comedian. He's been working for a number of years. I'm very familiar with his work. We get into that a little bit in the conversation. But more importantly than that is that I learned something in this conversation that absolutely blew my mind. I learned through Frank that there's a name for this condition that I've had this whole time. To borrow a phrase from that old TV show Dexter, my dark passenger, if you will. That thing that I've carried with me my whole life. That little bit of a tug that comes with every decision that says, big problem, small problem, you could kill yourself. I've had that my whole life. I still have it now. It's something that I never really put a name to. It was just, oh yeah, this is a thing that happens. And I know it's weird, but it's my thing. It's the strange malady that I've got to carry around with me. And I got to learn how to live with it because it's not going away. But apparently, that is chronic suicidality. I never ever thought there was a word for it. And why does it matter if there's a word for it? I'll tell you why. At least to me. When you can start defining things, you can start unpacking them. It gives you a place to put your feelings about those things. It gives words to those feelings. And it takes away some of the mystery, some of the unknown, and makes it known. It makes the unknowable knowable. And that makes it a lot less scary. So I'm going to get us into this conversation with Frank real quick. Don't forget to visit thementalhealthcomedian.com for all news about Frank, upcoming things. Believe it or not, there are still appearances happening in limited ways. There's Zoom meetings that can take place, and you can even find a phone number where you can talk to Frank. Now, without further ado, here is my awesome conversation with Frank King. Well, let's get started.
Yeah, what the hell?
Yeah, why not? So, first things first, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm 63 years old. I'm in the middle of a pandemic. How good could I be?
You know, it's funny. It's funny you bring that up, too, because there is a real opportunity here during this pandemic for some growth, some change, and yet that seems very smug to say when you're in the middle of feeling dragged down. I mean, and especially for you, someone who talks in front of crowds of people for a living. I mean, how do you handle people telling you, well, just, you know, why don't you just make a loaf of bread and learn how to crochet?
Yeah, or as the first daughter said, find something new to do.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like thanks handbag for the advice. Deal with China. Yeah, exactly. I feel bad for two groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
One is people who have had a job at length, where they go to work at 8 in the morning, come home at 5 in the afternoon, scheduled, rigid. You know, they really don't have to think about what they're going to do next because it's pretty much laid out for them day after day. And now they're working from home or they've been laid off. They're definitely at loose ends in an uncertain world. So, whereas as an entrepreneur at length, you know, you learn how to pivot to reinvent yourself, you know, over and over, depending on the situation in the economy and the world. And so I've pivoted to doing virtual keynotes. I've got a green screen, a really killer background that some people think is actually my living room. And, you know, and a microphone, good microphone lighting. So stand up, and I have all the people who are on the, you know, that I'm speaking to turn their microphones on. So they can actually speak to me. They go, hey, wait a minute. Okay. So it's very much live. No chat box, just, you know, hey, wait a minute, slow down. I missed that. So I've been able to do that. And my friends who are in the speaking business have been able to, for the most part, generally the younger ones who are willing to change,
yeah,
have been able to do that. And speakers bureaus that I work with are saying, you know, what's your virtual fee? Do you have a demo of you doing it virtually, which I do. But if you've been working, you know, working for a paycheck for a living for a long time, it's hard to make changes like that.
Yeah.
Second people I feel sorry for are the neurotypical, neuronormal people who are not used to waking up in an uncertain world every morning. And, you know, 9/11, it happened on one day. We began to rebuild. But this thing, you know, there's a surge, and yesterday we crossed that threshold of 1,000 deaths per day again.
Yeah.
And, you know, our kids going back to school. So I've got a keynote, actually, that I created called Social Distancing and Staying Sane. Don't worry about your mentally ill friends. Because as a person living with mental illness for decades and successfully high functioning,
yeah,
I have what's called a self-care plan, diet, exercise, good night's sleep, meditation, medication. And I have other techniques that I use to be able to get out of bed in the morning, which some neurotypical people are having difficulty doing now because of the uncertainty that surrounds them. So I'm pretty well positioned for a pandemic.
Yeah. You know, I found that I was too, in a lot of ways, for that very same reason. Because when you've got a mental illness, especially one like mine, I have manic depressive, bipolar, and I have that I have that lovely thing where you wake up in the morning and you get your shoes on to go for a run, and you think, should I brush my teeth first or should I kill myself? It's like that thing.
Hey, dude.
Yeah,
that's me.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's chronic suicidal ideation.
Absolutely. I didn't even know there was a word for it. I listened to your audiobook that you had put out, and that's free on your website. And
yeah,
when I heard you talking about that, I thought, I didn't know there was a phrase for that. I've dealt with this. I've dealt with this my whole life. I've just gotten used to it. I've gone to therapists, several different therapists, because, you know, once they get worn out, it's time to move on. I've tried medications. I've done all kinds of things. But when you're living with that level of uncertainty of however my brain chemistry is going to react to whatever the news in the world is today, who am I going to be when that happens? You sort of have to be ready to pivot. And I'm weirdly, uniquely prepared, more than a person who's never thought about suicide in their life.
Yes.
So yes, take me back a little bit farther. Like take me back to, first of all, I'd like to hear a little bit about the beginnings of when you discovered that you could do something with comedy?
Okay. Well, before we go, for your listeners' benefit, chronic suicidal ideation, you and I, this is the example I give, and I give it in my TED Talks, that my car is, suicide is a solution for problems large and small. It's always on the menu. And my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts on it: get it fixed, buy a new one, or I could just kill myself. And that's always option C. My brain just pops that up as, hey, we can do this. So what I found is every time I've spoken, except once, at least one person in the audience has come up, sometimes more than one, and they have chronic suicidal ideation. They're like you. They had no idea it had a name. They thought, maybe you did too, that just the way your brain worked, you're just some kind of freak.
Yeah.
And that there was nobody else out there like that. And so when I reveal that, the relief, I had a young woman come up at a college show after a college presentation. She said, thank you for your keynote. I said, you're welcome. She goes, but I got to tell you, it made me weep. I go, how did it make you weep? She goes, well, you know the story about your car? You know, get it fixed, buy a new one, or you could just kill yourself. She goes, I've been having those thoughts all my life. I didn't know it had a name. I thought I was just some kind of freak. And when I heard you say that out loud, she said, I realized for the first time in my life that I'm not alone, and I wept. That's my why, by the way, that epiphany for those folks. So that's chronic suicidal ideation to a T. And by the way, I've met clinicians who'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
So, I have a psychiatrist friend. He goes, what? There's a name for that? And you should know it. He goes, no, I've got it. I didn't know there was a name for that.
Yeah.
So, okay, so let's back up to comedy, how comedy started.
Yeah.
Because people always ask, which came first, the comedy or the mental illness? Yes.
Right.
Because I'm hardwired for depression, suicide, because, again, something that a lot of people have never heard of, generational depression and suicide. My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days. My grandmother used an old gas stove. My great aunt used an old Loctite refrigerator. And the joke that's in my first TED Talk is, what is it with my family of major appliances? I drive past Sears, I tear up. That's my family. Anyway, not only do we have generational depression and suicide, but we are a funny family. My sister, my cousin Tina, my mother was very witty, sort of a Dixie Carter designing women sort of.
Yeah.
Kind of a biting wit. So I came by it naturally. When I met my mother and father's contemporaries, and they said, what are you doing for a living? I would say comedy, and they go, that figures. But fourth grade was my first joke. I told the joke in fourth grade with the help of my teacher. She didn't realize she was my straight person, but she was. And all the kids laughed, and I thought, okay, I'm going to be a comedian. And then in 12th grade, I've been taking drama for 3 years, and I never got a good part, never got a speaking part. And I thought, you know what? If I did stand up, I could write, direct, produce, and star in my own little show every night.
Yeah.
And so just by chance, second semester, high school, senior year, they had a talent show. And I thought, well, I'm going to do stand-up. I was the first person ever to do stand-up at that talent show, and I won. And then my mother, being my mother, who's big on education, said, well, you're going to college first. I don't care what you do when you get out. You can be a goat herder for all I care, but you're going to be a goat herder with a college degree.
Yeah.
Hey, now. Hey, I'm on the phone. We have rescue dogs. So I went to Carolina, UNC Chapel Hill, and got two degrees, and oddly didn't do, you'd think I would have gotten into theater, communication. No, I just got a degree in political science and one in labor management relations and got out, married my high school sweetheart, and we moved to San Diego to work for an insurance company. And just by chance, in San Diego, there's a branch of the world-famous Comedy Store on Sunset.
Oh, yeah.
There's a branch in San Diego. And I would drive by that place and feel a magnetic pull. Now, here's the deal. My first wife was four square against comedy. And her father worked for an insurance company, and that's how I got hired, and they transferred to San Diego. And I wasn't doing open mic night. So my fourth TED Talk is Suicide, the Secret of My Success, Dead Man Talking. By the way, that's how I believe you get a TED Talk, is you have a really catchy title that they've got to read on.
Yeah.
And I didn't have to audition for that one. They read the title, called me up, and said, you're on. Yeah. Well, Suicide, the Secret of My Success is slightly counterintuitive.
Yeah.
I wrote it because that got me into comedy. Suicide, because I realized that as lovely as my first wife was, and she was, that we didn't belong together. But you know what they say, opposites attract. She was pregnant, I wasn't. And I was selling insurance, which I hated. Great business, but it just wasn't for me. And I wasn't going to the comedy store. And I thought, you know, if I don't do something soon, I'm going to kill myself. And then my second thought was, well, what the heck? I can divorce my wife, quit my job, try comedy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, hell, I can still kill myself.
Yeah,
that's
right.
How I got into comedy.
So, because this is a thing that actually I've discovered through various bits of trial and error, I've had that same mentality kind of come around and save me from things. I was in a poor situation. I had my wife and I, again, did not belong together, but were together. And
hey.
I had all these other things that I wanted to do. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that really changed my life for the better was I tried to do comedy for a while. And I didn't stick with it because of the hours. Honestly, that was just about it. Couldn't work comedy and a full-time job. And so it was like, well, one of these has to win and I got kids. I'm going to bet on the full-time job. The jury is still out on whether or not that was the smart decision. But the things that I did learn from doing comedy for a while was that there are worse things that can happen to you than whatever it is you think the worst thing that's going to happen is. And bombing in front of a crowd is probably the greatest thing that can ever happen to you as a human being, because it's terrifying. It feels like it's never going to end, and it does. It ends. And my worst bomb was my girlfriend said, oh, you're doing comedy. I had just moved to Colorado at that point. And she said, well, I can get you booked somewhere. I said, great. How much time will I get?
No.
You know, 5 minutes? She's like, no, you got 20 minutes. It's like 20 minutes.
Comedy work?
No, not the comedy works. It was an Irish restaurant. And they had music that night. And I was set up to do 20 minutes between the band's set.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And when I realized that that's what was happening, I realized this is not ideal. But I'm going to go up and I'll do 20 minutes. So I wrote out a set of material of what I thought I could do. And I blew through that 20 minutes probably in five, because there was no, I don't know if you've ever seen the way that people respond when they're at a restaurant and there's a band playing. They're kind of interested in their conversation and eating their food. And when the sound stops, they'll clap. But then someone has to make an announcement about a Dodge that needs to move because it's blocking somebody in, and you can't hear a thing they're saying. It's just
yeah.
That was me for 20 minutes.
No, I've been there, done that.
Oh, man. Yeah. And I was happy to do it. And it turned my insides to water. It was like I was molecularly torn apart and put back together, and I survived it. And it was like, well, if this is the worst thing that could happen, I can live through that. I can get past that. And then every time I got on stage after that, I was much more comfortable. I stopped drinking before I went on stage because I saw other people, you know, at the open mics just getting plastered before they got their name called, and then they couldn't deliver their jokes. It's like you gotta go up there ready to work, and you can't do that if you're cloudy. And I learned to use that fear to my advantage and to learn how to live with it. The same way that I learned how to recognize the suicidality inside myself. And so when you are, but this all kind of comes back to this bigger question that I wanted to ask, which is you get yourself up the ladder. And I mean, I remember seeing you on Evening at the Improv and you know, all of these things, you know what I mean? So I remember you, and it's funny the way you see somebody on TV and you go, oh, well, they did it. They figured it out. But then as a human being who has any level of success, you realize you take all of your baggage with you, no matter how high up you go or how far out you go. You're taking yourself with you. So if you're a person with issues, you're bringing those issues. So if you could tell me a little bit about how you discovered that success wasn't going to fix it.
Oh, that's easy. With clinical major depressive disorder, and this is in my keynotes, it's generally not situational. It can be triggered by a situation. That's, you know, we were in the recession, the last recession, which is a phrase I had hoped I'd never utter, the last recession.
Right.
Speaking of it, it's dropped off 80% overnight.
Yeah.
Practically overnight. And we lost everything in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and that situation, I learned what the barrel of my gun tastes like. Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger.
Oh, good.
A nervous laugh. Yeah. Yeah, a friend of mine came up to me at a keynote. He'd never heard me say that. And he said to me, and I quote, "Hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger?" I go, "Hey, man, can you try to sound a little less disappointed?" It's a great friend of mine. Anyway, your question was, give the question again, because I get off on a tangent.
Oh, no, that's fine. It's early. No, the question was, when did you discover that your levels of success were not going to fix the problem?
Oh, yeah, I can tell you exactly. I don't know what day or year it was, but I'd gone to the beach. We live in San Diego, and there are very few places you can walk a dog off leash in San Diego, but one of them is spectacular. It's on Coronado Island between the Hotel Del and the Navy base. It's an off-leash, probably the best off-leash dog park in the world. Gorgeous. And so we had a dog, Chelsea, and I took her there. We spent the afternoon, and it was a beautiful day. And I got in the car, and I was wretchedly depressed. And now you have to go back. To get back to San Diego, you go across the Coronado Bay Bridge, or the Coronado Bridge, and from which many people jump. And so at the bottom of the bridge, I started counting my blessings. And by the time I got to the top of the bridge, I had finished counting, and I was still wretchedly depressed. And I was thinking about jumping. And I realized that we were living in a condo paid for in La Jolla, which is a really nice neighborhood. We're the poorest people in a really nice neighborhood. And I had bookings, money in the bank, no credit card bills. I mean, life was... Married to a lovely young woman, beautiful dog, couple of cats. And I realized that at that moment that it was not situational for me, because I've been most depressed and suicidal at some of the best times in my life.
Yeah.
Situation could trigger it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's which people ask me to explain the difference between neurotypical sort of situational depression and depression. And that's what I tell them. Look, you know, you may be, because of the pandemic, situationally depressed. I would recommend getting evaluated. And if medication indicated, take the cheek swab DNA test, see which antidepressant works best with your metabolism. Mm-hmm. And just use it short term. Just figure, you know, this will pass, and the day will come when you'll think I can taper off. So, but that's the first time. That was mid-90s. I realized, hey, this is not normal. And that wasn't my first suicidal thought. My first suicidal thought had come several years earlier when I realized that not pursuing comedy was going to kill me. Yeah. I didn't change something. And so I did. And I met several comedians and entrepreneurs, had the very same thought process. You know, this is not my life. I should not be doing this. She's wonderful, but we don't belong together. And if I don't do something, I'm going to kill myself. Oh, wait. I could get rid of all this, try that. And if it doesn't work, hell, I can still kill myself.
Yeah. It's funny when you tell people that calmly and see the look on their face as...
Yeah,
as they try to do the mental gymnastics, because it is a different sort of situation when you're wired up like that. You kind of learn to live with it. You've got it inside of you. It's just part of your reality. And when you start talking to people and you forget and you say, you know, that thing that we all do when we, oh, wait, we don't all do that? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And I've occasionally have fun with neurotypical people. I was doing I did 2-3 hour suicide prevention CE programs, you know, continuing ed in Sacramento one day, and I was just exhausted at the end of the day. And I got in the Uber with a nice young man, the Uber driver, and he pulls off, and we're our eyes locked in the mirror, rearview mirror, and he says, "How you doing?" I thought, you know what? I'm gonna tell him I'm depressed and suicidal. How about you? He long pause. And he goes, what am I supposed to say to that? I said, do you really want to know? He goes, yeah. I go, you're supposed to ask if I have a plan. So a couple seconds, he goes, do you have a plan? And then he says, does it involve Uber? Brilliant.
Now that
is
good.
Yeah, that I've been retelling that story since then. I mean, it was brilliant. And that's the thing. Every now and then I get tired of saying, you know, I'm living the dream, I'm fine. In the book, you want to surround yourself with a pit crew. You know, people that love you for who you are and understand what you're going through, and you can tell them exactly how you're feeling, and they're not going to, you know, they're not going to try to fix it. They're not going to tell you what you should be doing. They're just going to listen. And so... that's one of the things I love about the book is, you know, practical action items on how you can deal with these things.
Well, and dealing with these things isn't something that just happens. For your life in particular, you had suicide in your family kind of from a young age. What were the conversations regarding mental health as you were growing up?
There were none. If you watch my first TED Talk, and trigger alert for anybody who is listening to this, and if you know if you're easily triggered about, you know, all things suicide, you might want to, you know, mute it for about 60 seconds. That generation, my mother's generation, the generation prior, my grandmother, my great aunt, nobody talked about it. When my mother and I found my great aunt, because my mother had gotten worried because she found my grandmother and then she couldn't reach my great aunt. Thought maybe, you know, given the family history. And my great aunt had glaucoma and was very depressed. And so my mother bundled me in the car at 4 years old. We drove over, let ourselves into her apartment, and walked around the apartment till we got to the kitchen. And in the kitchen, the only thing out of place was the butter, eggs, cheese, milk was on the counter, not in the old Loctite refrigerator. The kind of when you, if you by chance get in it, you're not getting out.
Yeah.
And what had happened was my great aunt decided to end her life. She called into the Loctite refrigerator and pulled the door to. And then at some point it changed her mind and tried to scratch her way out. And so my mother, not realizing what had happened, and I'm holding on to her skirt tail, walks over to the refrigerator, swings the door open, and my great aunt falls out and on top of me and pins me to the floor. Yeah. And I screamed for days, apparently. I had no conscious memory of any of that. And so they created a myth that if I ever ask anybody, you know, what it was like, you know, I don't recall, but what was it like when I found, my great aunt in the fridge?
all the adults had agreed to tell me that, well, she was sitting in there serenely with her hands folded in prayer. 2012, I recanted that myth. I recounted that myth to my cousin, who's 10 years old. And he goes, what? Serene? The old bat fell out on you, pinned you to the floor. And it all came rushing back. And the joke I wrote was, somebody said, here again, every now and then somebody neuronormal asks me a question and I tell them the truth. Have you ever been impacted by a suicide? I go, yeah, the old bitch fell out and pinned me on the floor.
Yeah, there is. I think it matters to be able to find the humor in things. It's just part of our humanity. Humor is one of the greatest things that we can have. It's one of the things that can lift us out. So if you can find the humor in the darkness, sometimes that's what you need to keep you afloat. You know, I'm the kind of person
that's why they booked
me. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Telling these kinds of stories is unusual, but everybody I know anyway has tried to stifle a laugh at a funeral when something silly happens. You know, that's just part of it. It's part of the human experience, and to deny that it is, you know, as if it's separate from everything, and it's solely a solemn issue, is to deny that part of the human experience.
Yeah, when I did my first TED Talk, I do what I tell my TEDx coaching clients to do, or assignments to do. Go to TED, look up your topic, and see how other people have handled it, TED or TEDx. So I typed in suicide in the search box on the TED.com site. And, you know, there are tens of thousands of talks on, you know, tens of thousands of things. And there were 3 talks on suicide.
Yeah.
And so I said to the audience, well, then it hit me. If you're good at suicide, you're not going to be recording a TED Talk.
Right.
Again, dark, but, you know, they didn't get that nervous laugh. But, you know, it's the laugh is what gets me the work. People ask me, being a comedian hold you back and getting bookings for suicide prevention? No, they prefer to have somebody come in and lighten it up in between the darkness. You know, it's easier to take all the other stuff if you can give them a little something to... Well, they call it comic relief for a reason.
Yeah. Do you think that it helps you?
Oh, dear God. Yes, Lord. How my family handled triumph and tragedy was humor. And, yeah, the darker, the better for me. The darker it is, the more therapeutic it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, you oftentimes can't joke with neuronormal people. We before the COVID, I would get together about once a month with anywhere from 2 or 3 to 6 of my mentally ill friends here in town. Then we have a crazy coffee clutch and take off our game faces and just be ourselves for an hour.
Yeah.
And could get away with talking about things, you know, making fun, poking fun, you know, saying socially inappropriate things about death and dying and suicide.
Yeah.
It definitely helps me. And I think it helps the audience. I think they see somebody on stage who's obviously high functioning and funny, and because everybody has kind of an idea what mental illness looks like, and generally I'm not what they had imagined.
Right.
And I give people cover. What I really do is and my clients tell me this all the time, we just walked in here to start the conversation on suicide, because if I start it, that gives anybody and everybody in the audience permission to give voice to their feelings and experiences without recrimination, because I open the door for them.
Yeah, it's a sticky subject, and it requires someone to come forward first. And if it can be
a couple on the dance floor,
exactly. That's exactly right. So tell me a little bit about what are some of your tools in the toolbox for when you're feeling these things now? Because I know that you just had. You just had an open heart surgery.
Yeah, I've had several.
So that's, I mean, there's something about that makes me nervous. You know, I think about, I think about Robin, you know, from it was his birthday yesterday. Not to date this recording too much, but you know, I think about that and the shift that, I mean, yeah, he had some other things going on for sure, but the shift that people say that they have after a heart surgery. I'm very curious, as a person who's done it a few times now, apparently, how has that affected you?
Well, the first one, my wife will tell you, after my first open heart surgery, I was wretchedly depressed. Didn't want to see anybody, talk to anybody, just was busy living. And my second one, she kept waiting for me to get depressed. And I don't know if the drugs have gotten better, you know, or how they, you know, the anesthesia is different. But I never did get depressed the second time. And maybe because somebody said to me, is it worse or better the second time knowing what you know about the heart surgery? I said, yes. it's worse because, you know, I know what's coming. It's better because I know what's coming. So that may have been part of the reason, you know, I'd survived the first one. The second one took far longer, 11 and a half hours. Very difficult.
Wow.
Yeah, I had 10% chance I wasn't coming out. The last thing I remember when they were prepping me that morning was I was making everybody laugh, and I'm thinking, I'm having a great show. My second thought was, I better, maybe my last one.
Right.
Again, there's that dark humor. When somebody asks about the pandemic, you know, how are you holding up in the pandemic? I go, look, here's the deal. I've got major depressive disorder, chronic suicidal ideation. I've had 2 aortic valve replacements, a double bypass, a heart attack in the woods by myself, 3 stents, and I lost to a duck puppet on Star Search. This is not the worst thing that's ever happened to me.
But all of these things make you interesting, if you're willing to see that.
Yeah, the trick is mining the... Well, I got to tell you, my best comedy students ever were the ones that came to my stand-up for mental health class, started by a guy named David Grenier in Canada. It's formerly people with mental illness who want to write and perform stand-up comedy based on the mental illness. You have to have a diagnosis to get in. You have to have a diagnosis to teach it. So it's part of peer counseling, part comedy class.
Mm-hmm.
And they were amazing. I said, Trish, what do you got? She goes, well, my boyfriend wants to break up with me. I go, well, why is that? Well, he said he wants to see other people. I said, what'd you say to him? I'm bipolar. Give me a minute. And that's the way it came out of her brain. Just like, I mean, normal people don't write that tight. There's not a syllable in there. It doesn't move the narrative forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just brilliant. I believe that mental illness is often a combination of mental illness and mental ableness. All the wiring's the same.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's the ability and the disability are one and the same. And if we could take kids and convince them of that, look, yeah, you got a disability, but here's what they never tell you. You have abilities your peers can't touch.
Yeah.
We could reduce stigma and bullying by changing the frame for the kids and their peers.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much that you can do when you recognize the weakness and strengths for what they are. But it can be very difficult to see those things when you're so close to them, and especially when, you know, you've got the weighted blanket of yourself on yourself and you're not aware that it's on there. There are days when I get up and I go for a walk and I'm suddenly aware that I'm not depressed. And then it's, oh yeah, I didn't even realize that I had the ankle weights of depression on for the past 3 weeks because I'm just, yeah. It's just my reality. I'm just used to it. And I think that that's a thing that can definitely happen to people, and just being mindful of it. Even when you're a person who's dealt with it your whole life, there are times when you've got your own blind spots.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I've more than once asked myself why do I feel this way? Duh. It's back.
Yeah, there it is. I thought he left.
Yeah. Well, for me it's like somebody's turned up the force of gravity for a day or so and then they turn it back down.
Yeah.
The metaphor I use, I don't know if you saw my TED talk on Suicide, the Secret of My Success.
Yeah.
The metaphor I use at the end is about Sisyphus and the rock and the hill, and how everybody with a mental illness wakes up with a rock and a hill every day, and some days the rock's small, some days it's big, some days the hill is not so steep. And the neuronormal people are waking up with a rock and a hill they haven't ever had to deal with before.
Right.
And so, to answer your question, I do the my safe care plan is diet. I'm on a keto diet, and I fast.
Mm-hmm.
Intermittent fasting. I eat for an hour a day, and I fast for 22 to 24 hours.
Wow.
And exercise. I've got some exercise equipment at home. So diet, exercise, good night's sleep. And I tell people this, you need to, even though you don't have to get go to work, you need to get up at the same time every day and go to bed roughly the same time every night. And schedule your meals and your meditation. And then I do meditation. Schedule your meals, schedule some meditation, some quiet time, schedule your media time so you're not consuming it 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
And then medication. And I say, you know, if medication is indicated, get the cheek swab test so they can, they call it precision medicine, so they can narrow down the list of antidepressants or whatever, so you're not having to go on taper off. And I do gamification. If you can't get out of bed, I make a list of six things to do. And the game is, if as soon as I scratch off number six, I can go back to bed, pull the covers over my head, and binge watch Netflix, even if it's 3 p.m. broad daylight, because I win. So that gamification gets a lot of my stuff. And then I have a thing called half hour power, where I've got a task like taxes I have to do. So what I'll do is I'll set my iPhone for 30 minutes, and I'll work on taxes for 30 minutes. And then for the next 30, I can do any other chore or whatever that I have on my list. Cut the grass, you know, clean the house. And then when the alarm goes off, another 30 minutes on taxes. Because I can do anything for about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
So that way I get a lot accomplished in 30-minute chunks. So that's another technique that I use to get moving. Because, you know, moving can be the, it's not a panacea, but it is, you know, an antidote to, you know, depression, anxiety. It helps, at least helps me. And I stopped saying that I battle depression because battle implies I can win, and I cannot.
Right.
I can tie, like an uneasy truce like North and South Korea, or I can lose and die, but I cannot beat it. So what I do is there's a martial art called Aikido, and the principle is rather than opposing the force of your opponent, you blend with it.
Yes.
And so I try to blend with the energy of the depression. Not oppose it, but move, you know, blend with it and move forward with it.
I think that what makes that that definition of high functioning so important is that ability to put forth a plan and a schedule, because that planning and that scheduling, as far as this is when I'm going to wake up, this is when I'm going to go to bed, these are the things that I have to get done, putting those things in place can help you through when you don't feel like you have it in you to do it. You can almost autopilot yourself to get things done. And your brain doesn't know that it's autopilot. Your brain just knows that you ticked something off of the list that you were supposed to do. And so you get that little bit of dopamine rush. It doesn't know that you didn't cure cancer. It just knows that you filled the dishwasher.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's I can just get moving. The art of the start, as what's his name, Kawasaki would say.
Yeah.
For me, it's all about the art of the start. If I can just get started, you know, I can be productive. And I've been doing podcasts, webinars, radio interviews, and teaching neurotypical people how all this works, because they're not used to having to deal with this. And I had a friend of mine call me up. He goes, look, I know you're in the mental health business. I need an answer. I said, okay. He goes, I want you to tell me, I've got symptoms. There's got to be a name for this. He goes, I eat too much, can't eat, sleep too much when I can't sleep. When I do wake up, I just can't drag myself to the bathroom, do something as simple as shave and wash my hair. You know, I don't care about social activities. Is there a name for that? And I said, yeah, it's Wednesday.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But also, you've got to be able to forgive yourself for those Wednesdays. because you can't just keep beating yourself up over and over again. It's part of your recognition of what it is you're dealing with. There are going to be days where what you might consider to be a failure happens. The key is really in recognizing it for what it is as a temporary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the end of the world. And be, I always tell people, you got to be kind to yourself. Don't, you're home, yes. You don't have to be super productive. Just give yourself a break. The world is, the world's an awful place right now.
Right. Let me pose this as well. Because right now there does seem to be this level of expectation on people that they're going to, they're going to have all of this time sitting in their houses. And so they may as well write a screenplay or a novel or, get themselves in the best physical shape they've ever been in their life. There's a lot of that going around. And I think that in some ways it can be motivated or motivating, but in other ways it can be daunting, and it can help people feel like, maybe they're not managing their global pandemic properly. What do you think about that?
A friend of mine posted a thing on Facebook. I used to say to my wife, I'll get to that when I've got time. Dear Lord, I've got time, and she's got that list. I think it's, again, you got to be kind to yourself. And I find myself very busy, and I couldn't figure out, because normally I'd be leaving town in the summer. I'd be working the cruise boats in Alaska, and still I got everything done. I thought, now, why am I not getting everything done? And I realized because all the things that I had put off when I had a real, real place to go and do and live, I'm doing all these projects. I mean, it's dozens of them. And so, I have the pressure to be hyper productive now that I've got the time. Really should be using this better.
Right.
I've got to take advantage of this.
Well, this has been an excellent conversation. I could talk to you all day, but then we wouldn't get anything else done. So I just wanted to say thank you for coming on and sharing this with me today.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. A fellow traveler.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. Thank you to Frank King for coming on the show. If you want to get some more Frank King in your life, and I know that you do, go to thementalhealthcomedian.com. I have also added a bevy of links to YouTube videos of comedy routines, speaking engagements, and all kinds of stuff in the feed below. So just scroll down. There's a ton of links there. And you can also find them on the post on Instagram and Facebook. But that's all I got for you this week, folks. I want you to do one thing for me if you can, or if you're interested. Go check out our sister podcast, Let's Laugh About Death. It is hosted by Tim Rooney. It's the dramedy podcast that celebrates life while contemplating the inevitable. But until then, don't kill yourselves out there.